Okay, so I just want to talk a little bit before lunch at half twelve, and just want to look a bit at this theme of creation and destruction, and just this practice that, you know, the underneath everything that we do, really, is this practice of becoming present in the moment, present with the senses, and then present in a way to the interconnected nature of things. And in a sense, we're present in that moment to the mystery of being both separate and connected. So there's something kind of crucial at some level about the idea of sovereignty, of our own particular place, and the uniqueness of our own energy, the uniqueness of our own contribution to life. But that idea is, of course, held in tension with the experience of interconnectedness. Now, there's obvious interconnectedness, you know, things that affect us, news, things that happen, things we do to each other. But the other thing that Jung put his finger on so adeptly, really, is this mysterious set of connections that he called synchronicity, which is the sort of simultaneous two things connecting together, not in a causal nature, not in an obvious I do this and therefore this happens, but I experience this and I encounter this and it has meaning for me, precise meaning. And in some ways, I suppose the whole nature of therapy or inner work is about trying to kind of get present and distinguish between meaning and things that have meaningful connection and things that are artifacts. Because obviously I am capable of creating, and we all are capable of creating a sense of myself and a sense of my world that feels coherent and has meaning, but can be based upon a total kind of illusion, based upon my wish to be powerful, my wish to be safe, my, you know, wish to dominate the world. Or I can be in a place where I'm just present in myself and I notice something happening in me, and I encounter somebody and I have a conversation which isn't apparently about me, but yet absolutely connects into the heart of whatever I'm dealing with. And lots of different spiritual traditions really talk about this mysterious connectedness, you know, sort of, I mean, out of India you have this amazing image of the net of Indra, which is a net of jewels, and it's an extraordinary imagery, because each jewel reflects every other jewel in the net. I mean, it's the sort of thing when you think about it, it does your head in somewhere. So you have this net anyway, which is this image of interconnectedness, and then you have these faceted jewels that reflect that contain the reflections of every other jewel in the net. Or even the Buddha saying, you know, speaking about everything being independent, codependent relationship to everything else. And Buddha, you know, Buddha does it in a very sparse kind of way, without any much imagery really, where he says, from the arising of this, that arises. This being, that comes to be. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. This being not, that becomes not. Where this and that is everything. So it's the Buddha's image of the world. Everything is connecting and affecting everything else all the time. So the creation of any part of the universe, any being doing something, affects everything else. And you know, this when the science gets more and more sophisticated, you look at things like quantum entanglement, where things completely, apparently vastly apart from each other, simultaneously affect each other. Or you get chaos theory, where if you look at things like weather patterns, where you know the classical story of the kind of flapping of the butterfly's wings, which is a kind of apocryphal story, but the idea behind chaos theory is that very small can affect the very big. And what that means in a way, really, what that means for us in a sense is that we are constantly being affected by mysterious entities, really. I think, and we are doing the same. One of the things you get in mythology that looks at this image, you get the creator goddesses are sometimes weaver goddesses. They weave, they kind of weave and unweave the world into being. You get an image of it in Homer's Odyssey, where I mean, a lot of the action in the Odyssey is all about Odysseus and this sort of and he's having great adventures. But actually, one of the most powerful figures in the Odyssey is Penelope. Penelope, and because she sleeps in this. I mean, she's almost a hidden goddess figure in the Odyssey, because she's got this extraordinary bed. She sleeps in this bed that's sort of built out of the world tree. There's this great vast olive tree that her bed is built about, and by day she weaves. She's weaving a shroud for Odysseus, and by night she unweaves it. There are numbers of goddess figures who do this. They weave things into being and then they unweave. Classically, in the Greek tradition, you have the three fates who kind of who spin, who weave, and who cut the thread. Now, the reason that these kind of images you find them in Native American tradition, you get Spider Woman who weaves the world into existence. She's
different type of spider woman.
I know. I know.
Oh, yeah. Is it a bit
So,
like the white heart in action?
it is. It is.
Yeah.
We are there. We're there. That's right. These images are kind of ubiquitous. These are the kind of, yeah, that's right. The Spider Woman, Spider Man, but and there's just something about this. And in Welsh tradition, the goddess Ceridwen, she didn't weave really, but she has this cauldron out of which everything goes into and everything comes out of, in a sense.
Penelope is interesting and different in that it's
Yep.
a non-linear image
Yeah.
because it's constantly fluid,
Yes, totally.
whereas with the fates,
Yeah.
linear time
Yeah.
sort of thing.
It is, yeah, and actually it's interesting. The Homer Penelope is a much more interesting image in that sense, because she weaves and she unweaves, weaves and she unweaves, and she's this kind of hidden, and she's this interesting figure really, because she keeps the house. She, in a way, she keeps the everything going, and the sort of and she what she does is lie down and dream. You know, she has each night she has these powerful dreams, and she's constantly. There's a big parallel if you're interested in the Odyssey. It's interesting to look at it, because actually, if you read the Odyssey in detail, you will see there is a strong parallel between the very internal things that Penelope is doing and the external things that Odysseus is doing. And all the energy, of course, goes to Odysseus. He's doing the apparently exciting thing, but it's actually Penelope is this kind of hidden creatrix who is continually holding the home, keeping everything, but is also destroying as well. So she's also this figure who weaves and unweaves.
It's a way to keep time still, isn't it? It's a way
Yeah.
to stop
Yeah.
things happening.
And to enable things to continue, yes, to enable continuance as well. So she keeps the hearth, she keeps the home, she nurtures the tree somewhere. And what she's working with are the energies of chaos, actually, because the suitors in the Odyssey are these chaotic, who want to take possession of Penelope, and she eludes them all, really. There's a lot of interesting stuff she does in it. But it's all pointing somewhere. These various stories are sort of pointing at a sort of a vision of the universe where because weaving is the threading of things together. If you when you weave them, you create something out of simple elements that can be extraordinary. And you look at things like the carpets on the floor that have been, they're just a collection of threads. You know, they come out of very simple, very simple dyed threads that have somehow, I don't understand weaving really, but I've had a friend who's a weaver, and she wove that cushion just behind you there, and her room is to be extraordinary. She used to have this weaving room and this loom and this all these kind of coloured threads, which are just coloured threads, and out of that she could make stuff. You know, she could kind of stuff that looks that has a real substance, but is really the things woven together. And in a way, you see, what we do when we're just present in our experience and with things, with our senses, with our awareness, is that we also are engaged in, through perception itself, we're engaged in an act of weaving. We weave and unweave the world. We choose. Because that energy of choice, so where to put your energy, even what to look at, in some way isn't it itself a kind of creative act. Now, one of the things that quantum physicists discovered is a powerful thing to take on broadly, is this idea of the observer effect, that the observer actually, that there is, in a sense, there's no objectivity. The observer creates the observed, creates the experience that arises, that you're seeking to measure. The act of observation is in itself a creative kind of act. Now it doesn't appear like that. So the world appears stable mostly, unless we're kind of working on ourselves in a particular way, or unless particular things are happening, right? So because what happens is our creative abilities to perceive, to create, to intend, become stabilized, because we create a kind of, because we need a degree of stability in our lives in order to function. So our energies are designed to create a world around us that appears stable, that we can bear to live in. Now, one of the kind of complicated things about that is that of course we make decisions normally quite early on in our life about things we can bear and what things we can't bear, and we create situations then that may not be ideal for us, but actually the out of the material, which is in our own experience and the things that are around us, it's not a sort of, we're not omnipotent infants able to create whatever we like. Creation is because it is an act of perception and interchange, confluence. We create some out of the material we find within us and the material that is outside it, something that we can continue to live in. And in a way, that's the root of patterns of human patterning, is that we work with a kind of that we are presented all the time with a shifting, changing, moving universe, and in order to continue to bear to live in this, we have to create enough stability and connectedness that we can just continue. Now that, in a sense, we could say, breaks down into our sense of ourself, our image of our internal image of ourselves, and our internal image of the world. And mostly, and it's not a quick, for most of us, it's not a very rigid image. I mean, very often when people come into psychotherapy, they come in because they've got very rigid images, and they've come up against something in their life. You know, for men, it's often relationship. And they've got into a relationship and they can't stand it, and then they come and see a therapist because their wife's made them come. It's a classic, classic sort of thing. But for most of us, if we're not that rigid, the worldview and sense of self is sufficiently fluid to be able to tolerate a certain degrees of change. But then things happen. Donald Trump happens. Astonishing. Not just on Donald Trump, other things happen to us. But when that happens, when something that's outside the flexibility of our field, then there's various things we can do with that. We can kind of expand our field. We can open. We can reorganize ourselves, or we can encapsulate the experience and make it often by demonizing it. And this is a bad thing, and I'll put it in the box of bad things. Or we can sort of somehow buttress that about with good things. Well, actually, you know, Donald Trump is only there for 4 years. There's all these other institutions, or there's another thing that we can do, which is to really let the universe in without surrendering sovereignty. Sovereignty is really important. So that sense of will and groundedness. And that's why there's this fundamental exercise of keeping coming back to the body and the senses and finding our feet in a way in that. It's kind of fundamental, right? And it's when you talk about, it's the difference between the thing that you're saying, when you feel the universe coming towards you and you feel in yourself, as opposed to when you've lost that kind of ground and then you're in chaos. So we all need that anchoring kind of place. And then there's, if we can, in a way, embrace that kind of sovereignty, embrace that kind of presence, and then be with the mystery of whatever is coming towards us. The inevitable, whether we like it or not, the inevitable, the reality that Donald Trump is now one of the most powerful men in the world. And each morning seems to be doing terrible things, issuing terrible edicts. Right, so we can, you know, and sort of, and how can we be with that? So that we can ignore it, obviously. We can kind of just demonize it, or we could even try and convince ourselves that maybe it'll be a good thing in the long run. We could do all of that, but actually the more potent thing to do in some ways is to be present in ourselves and present with the mystery, inexplicable mystery of that. Without surrendering our own position, without kind of manipulating our perception of the other, we then in between, this is the image of being almost in between the grail and the wasteland. So in that place, we start to take the position of the white heart, that is this fluid, creative, mysterious kind of being that can move between the opposites. And that links with the thing we were looking at right at the beginning of the course, so this idea of the song of the Tao, this inner stillness. Because as you come into this sense of inner stillness, this kind of presence right at the heart of us, what starts to happen is the Welsh, as I said, I think right at the beginning, that with this Welsh word Tao, which has got odd similarities with the Chinese word Tao, represents a stillness that moves. And in a way, I suppose the white heart is a sort of more graphic image of this kind of moving stillness that happens as we stay connected, as a sense we stay connected to our own sovereignty. We invite that grail presence into our heart, and then we are with the aspect of the withered land. And in that moment, then we become the white heart. We become this kind of mediating presence.
It's a bit like Persephone becomes the medial goddess.
Yes, she moves between. She moves between the worlds. Exactly, same sort of thing, right? Because yes, Persephone is a good image for that. Because she goes down into the depths, and she goes into, and then there is winter. Then there is no life. There is withering, and she comes up with the spring. So she works with both energies. So she is simultaneously the goddess of new life, of flowers opening, and she is the queen of the underworld, the queen of death. You know, so she's an interesting figure from that point of view.
I don't know where I brought that, but there's that thing a bit about the wasteland of the poem, and he's sort of saying that it's often spelt wrong. It's spelt as the wasteland, whereas it's not, and this is important, it's the wasteland, it's two words.
Yes.
So, you know, it's a land that doesn't have to be like that.
No, that's right. No, that's right. I mean, the land remains the land, and
it's essentially a wasteland.
No. Or it can be whatever it is. It can be the fertile land. It can be transformed into the fertile land, or it can go back into the wasteland or the wasted land. You know, the You know, so there's and in a way though, this process of the mediation between these opposites and having the and being able to be with, and the sort of figure you have to be in this is, I mean, the white heart image is an interesting one because it has this kind of it's sort of otherworldly, but it's also very solid. It's a stag, so it's got that kind of, but it's also mutable. It also kind of, it's a moon-colored stag, right? So it's a sort of, I mean, stags are sometimes these red, powerful, male, solar, sometimes, but the white stag is moon-colored. So it's a paradoxical kind of image. It's a stag that could also be a hind. It could also be a Bambi. It could also be, can be whatever form it wants to be, because it's a mediating principle. And the thing about mediating principle, which we're going to look at a lot over the next couple of weekends, is there is a precision. It's not fluffy. If you're going to mediate between opposites, this is a bit like working with a nuclear reactor. Right, if you're going to work with the image of growth and life, and work with the experience of growth and life, and the experience of something withering. And if you're going to mediate those, well, actually, you're bringing two very different, very powerful energies together. And this is why that sense of sovereignty and groundedness is important, because these energies, in a sense, meet in you. But the point of connection between them depends upon your capacity to be with both of them and to enable a creative connection. And that's incredibly hard, you know. In a way, that's the fundamental thing we're going to keep on looking at, because let's end on this because we need to go over lunch. But take the image of Trump, who in a way is a sort of, you know, if I think about, well, okay, how can I, if I just stay with myself for a moment, and I come into my own sovereignty, and I come into the kind of my feeling of horror, my feeling of rage, and so how can I meet Trump from without being overwhelmed by Trump, without wanting to kill Trump? How can I meet that? And almost that's the conundrum, that's the kind of dilemma. How can I find a way to meet that vainglorious oppressive energy? I can't do it in words, really, but what I could do, I mean, I can rage, I can rant, but if I just stay, what happens to me? If I stay present to myself and don't lose my own sense of sovereignty and my own sense of connection with the deeper, and then feel towards Trump,
get bigger.
And it doesn't only get smaller, in some ways there's a more precision, so I get more a sense for what happened to me just then, as I get as I connect to Trump, it's not just Trump, I mean there's Trump, but that sort of deeper archetypal energy of rage, terror, fear, nationalism, it's like I connect, so it gets more precise, right? I have a more precise relationship with it. Rather than I just hate Trump, I'm saying too well, but when I so the mediation thing brings me into clear relationship with something, and he becomes less of, and I also, and in that I sort of, he becomes more of a man and less of a devil. He becomes and there's something around and behind him that is an archetypal energy that he is connected with and has become surrendered to. Right, that's what's. I'm not saying I'm right about that, but that's kind of what happens, right? So that's.
Sorry, John.
Yeah. It also breaks the spell of the glamour.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And makes something real.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the schoolyard bully for me needed to be shored up by weaker boys. So
yeah.
He's still a powerful figure, but
yeah.
He's become much, much younger. So.
That's right. I think that's right. And sorry, you wanted to say something,
John. I was going to say something about. So this thing yesterday, so I have to kind of admit to having a bit of an obsession about it.
Yeah.
kind of looking online every time I have a break to think, what's he doing now? Yesterday, and we were talking about it in the car on the way, this kind of extraordinary moment where him and Theresa May, he's got a red tie and she's wearing a red suit, and they're holding hands in the White House. It's kind of just this extraordinary, bizarre thing, but somehow it kind of humanises them both a bit.
Yes, that's right.
And in that, and we were talking about this, and in that is the promise that he's going to get to meet the Queen.
Yes, that's right.
So you bring a kind of,
you bring him in.
The archetype of the royal, the Queen.
The Queen sovereignty, yes, absolutely.
And something in him feels like he's kind of, he's dumbed down a bit, or something in him that he
was contained, wasn't
he? Into the archetype. There's something very odd that's happened.
Yes, I think so too.
And I don't know whether Theresa May's just gone in and said, right, you've got to knock it off, or, you know, what's happened. But there's something quite extraordinary in that moment of holding hands.
I know, it is interesting.
I kept looking at it thinking, that's bizarre.
Yeah, I know, it is interesting.
The other thing for me about all that and the rest of it is the ritual of it.
We're
mesmerised by a ritual. I was talking about the glamour. Glamour in the sense of magical acting that creates a spell bound. If you can cut through that knot, you can see them as ordinary. You can see the narcissism. How badly do I dislike that? How badly do I dislike the narcissism in myself?
Yeah, that's right.
Pissed off I am with myself.
You
know, and it brings it into proportion.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right, and I think that in that moment, really, that is when we step into the position of being the White Hart, of being the mediating kind of figure that can, and in that place, you can do something else with it. You can start to work with it in a way, I think, and that, you know, obviously we're talking about big national events here, but that's true for anything. I think any set of opposites we experience in our lives is sort of, you know, so coming into. But it's dependent upon, in the beginning, of finding a sense of sovereignty in yourself. Because without that kind of anchoring sense and connection, if you like, to the sort of, if you like, your own source of life and goodness, it's too overwhelming, you know. And then we're bouncing all over the place. As we start there, and then as we reach out, if you like, it's almost like as we create the space of the grail around us and in us, then we reach out towards whatever it is, whatever the disturbing or lost energy is, and then that's when the kind of alchemical kind of process starts to happen. Something else starts to come into being, really.
What came up for me was working with a particular client, and I got the kickback this week, and I feel, because I think we were working with her opposite. And working and sort of like digesting them or being with them. And then this week, it's sort of like I'm receiving a kick from a horse or a donkey. What's that about? But very subtle, it was there.
Well, it would be, because I think that's the thing. When we work with this, we're working with energies under tension, right? So what can happen is in a way, that's what that's why we do need to be quite robust when we're doing this, because actually what happens is you hold them in tension, they go out of tension, and you get whacked or something happens, so that's because it's why they're kind of in the alchemical process, which I'm going to look at a bit later on. One of the key things around it is the alchemical vessel. The sealing it's a process of creating a hold. So as well as creating a sense of sovereignty, you create a holding field that can hold the energies, these opposite energies, under tension. Right, it's a process of fusion that happens. Actually, it's the opposite of fission. So as you hold, and it's a bit like, you know, when you hold two poles of a magnet together, you know, it's like that kind of tension that happens. It wants to do that, because that's kind of what you're doing. You're holding the opposites together, and the friction between the two opposite energies creates a third thing. But you've got to be able to hold that together long enough for something else to happen.
That's a triple spiral.
Yeah, exactly like that.
Bid, bend, bid, bond,
exactly. Yeah. It's exactly bid, bend, bid, bond. You, in your body, you bridge between the separate worlds, and therefore the war happens in your body, in a sense. It's the body being the for awareness in that sense.
Yeah.
Just on the moon, I was just reading last night about how did the moon get there, and various theories about it. I won't get obviously go into why they probably don't hold up, but the assumption is that we were hit by another planet, and so the moon is the Earth was there already, but the moon, according to that, which is now what is generally thought. That's why we've got the spin, that's why we've got the tilt, that's why we've got, you know, like, so it's not so, it's sort of just up there and sort of inert and shiny and nice. It is, and responsible for tides. It is also, well, the collision is also responsible for the tilt and the turn, the spin.
That's right, and therefore creates the world.
The world's
That's absolutely right, and so the moon and the Earth are one in that, in a sense, rotating around the barycenter, so there's a sort of because the barycenter is there's the deep center of the Earth, right? So there's a sense in which that kind of center of gravity, we think of it just as being the Earth, but it's actually the Earth and the moon together. That's the stable form that's formed. So that's a very interesting thing to say, actually.
Is that the matter that you can't see? I can't remember.
No, that's dark. We think of dark matter. No, this is a more dynamic thing in that we think of the moon and the Earth as separate, but they're actually one system. So the center point of when we think of the center of the Earth, it's actually the center of the Earth. That the actual point is the center of the Earth, not the center of the dynamic system formed by the Earth and the Moon. That's what holds it. That's the center point that holds the system in dynamic balance. And again, it's part of this interconnected thing. We think of the Moon as just up there, but actually the Moon and the Earth are one entity, in a way. Yeah, that's kind of like that. It's an interconnected system, right? So the spin of the Earth, which of course creates the whole life on Earth, out the spin, nothing happens. Is created by the interaction with the Moon. If the Moon were not there, this wouldn't be going on. Well, it takes us out of our normal sense, you see, and actually it's great you brought that in anyway, Marcella. I'll finish because we need to go for lunch, but because we're used to this idea of separation, right, of a separate solid universe, and when we think of the centre of the Earth, you think of it as not like the ultimate solid thing, but actually this is a system in dynamic balance, and the actual centre isn't just the physical center of the Earth. That isn't where the barycenter is. The center point is the place that balances the dynamic between the Earth and the Moon.
And they think the center spins as well, don't they?
Well, the center, everything else spins. Yes, the center does spin.
The core spins,
yes, totally. I mean, everything spins. I mean, that's the whole thing. The solidity of the Earth is an illusion. It's a constant, but it's a balanced moving system.
Without the Moon, the world would tip on its side, so it would spin. So we wouldn't. The poles are held at their place in relation to the Sun by the Moon, aren't they? Without it starts to swing wildly,
And life wouldn't. When life wouldn't exist,
the seasons would fall apart,
and life couldn't possibly exist in that sense. So the Moon and the Earth together have created a stable system that feels solid because it's stable.
The Moon's like Penelope.
In a way, yeah, that's an interesting way to think of it. Yeah. Let's stop because we need to go and have our lunch. And we'll come back.